These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 5th, 2018. Spring has sprung here in Northeast Ohio, and I don't believe it is more beautiful anywhere else on the planet when the sun is shining, the temperatures are warm, and everything's in bloom. We're finally out riding, walking, and running, and of course doing yard work, the stuff that's been lurking under the snow and ice for months. With that in mind, my first guest decided he didn't really care what the weather was like and began his most current journey in Key West a few months ago. Tom Helbig is an adventurer, a lover of life, and a minimalist. He takes everything with him, and when he is at home in Dayton, Ohio, lives in a Dodge Sprinter van, replete with all his worldly possessions, of which there just aren't too many. The trip he's taking now is moving up the East Coast, and I catch up with him somewhere near Rehoboth Beach in Delaware. We talk about all kinds of things, including some of the upcoming events he puts on over the summer when he gets back to Ohio. Then after a break, we're going to stay on the East Coast to speak with Brian Chapman of Chapman Cycles. Winner of a prestigious NABS award this year, Brian builds classic steel lug bikes, touring and randonneuring being among his favorites. We'll find out all about Brian and his work in the second half of the show. So let's meet Tom Helbig, Mr. Tom Foolery himself. Hello, Tom. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hi, Diane. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, you live in Ohio and I live in Ohio. You do insane, crazy things. Everybody knows I do insane, crazy things. How come we don't know each other if we've lived in Ohio all these years?
Well, apparently there's some secret society of people that do insane things. But, you know, eventually we find each other.
As we did, thanks to Kim Perry from Bike Virginia. We'll have to thank her later. I'd like to know more about your crazy things. Everybody already knows about mine. Tell us a little bit about you and your background, where you grew up and, you know, the kinds of things you've been doing. And then we'll get on with, you know, this ride craziness that you do.
Well, let's start out by saying crazy is a matter of perspective, right?
True.
I don't find anything crazy about riding bicycles and paddling and riding big wheels and just having fun with life. I wish that would be a little more mainstream instead of being considered crazy. So I'll use that as a baseline. I grew up in the Cleveland area. Thankfully, I had parents that were the type that said, go outside and play and be back for dinner. And then after dinner, they'd say, go outside and play again and be back before it got dark and for bedtime. So that's really the basis of my interest in the outdoor lifestyle. And I'm very grateful for that upbringing. Spent a lot of weekends camping at state parks in Ohio and then going to beach vacations that were with my family and two brothers that were always camping based. I think I stayed in a hotel as a youth maybe 4 or 5 times total.
Wow.
Yeah, and then growing up fishing on Lake Erie with my father. So that's the base of it all. And then in my adult life, I just have found myself getting more and more interested in cycling, fly fishing, kayaking, anything outdoors. And in the last 10 years or so, I've really gotten excited about bicycle travel and human-powered adventure. And the bicycle is just something that really makes me happy.
Yeah, it makes us all happy, doesn't it? Yeah.
Even when it sucks, you're still kind of smiling, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Climbing those hills, you know, in pouring rain, whatever it is. So back in 2016, you completed a Southern Tier tour. You went from San Diego to Key West. What inspired that particular ride?
I was very interested in bicycle travel. So I had done a fair amount of kind of just weekend warrior bike touring trip, going to a local park and doing a one night overnight with friends and coming back home type of thing. And then in 2009, I did the Ohio to Erie trail ride from Cincinnati to Cleveland. So that was my first longer tour, several days. And then I did the Allegheny Passage and CNO trail. So I added a few more days from Pittsburgh to DC. And the more I traveled via bicycle, the more I wanted to do it, if that makes sense.
It does.
So I fell in love with bicycle travel, the people that I would meet along the way, the places that I would see that you couldn't see from a car, the conversations I would get in with people because they're curious about what I'm up to with a bunch of bags on my bicycle. And so I just started to seek out other rides, and I looked at the Adventure Cycling Association website, and that feels like Christmas, looking at all the possibilities of long rides that are out there. And I thought about, then started to think about doing a cross-country ride. And I also wanted the ride to be more meaningful than just some dude riding his bike across the country, because really, in the scheme of things, who cares? I mean, it's cool, but it's really more personal than it is for others to really care about it. And I have a passion for working with people with disabilities, so I had came up with a concept that as I rode across the country, I would do volunteer work for Special Olympics. My goal was to do at least one volunteer day in each state. And then also do fundraising for Special Olympics as I traveled across the country. So that was the goal of that particular journey. And I'm happy to say that I made it. I'm here to talk about it.
So right. It. I'm still here. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tom Helbig. We are talking about his life on a bicycle, which sounds like a lot of fun. And if you want to hear something that's a lot of fun, you need to hear his website, TomFooleryOutdoors.com. So just keep that in mind as we move forward with this conversation. So you are now in the midst of another adventure. You are somewhere on the East Coast, starting in, where did you start, in Key West?
That's right. Yeah, starting Key West. So when I did the Southern Tier ride, I didn't know it at the time, but that was leg number one of what I'm now calling the Tom Foolery Good Vibes Tour. So I wanted to take the energy of my Southern ride across America, the volunteer service, the positive energy, the connections that I made with people, and continue that. So now my goal is to complete the loop around the United States. So hence I picked up in Key West, and now I'm traveling up the Atlantic coast of the United States. I'm currently near Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, and I'll venture up to Maine and then start trekking across the northern U.S., ultimately over to Washington State and down the Pacific coast to San Diego.
So this is one of those, I don't know how you're doing it questions. How are you doing this? How are you paying for this wonderful adventure on the road?
Right, because I'm either completely dirt poor and begging or I'm filthy rich, right? I get these questions all the time.
No, I don't have assumptions like that. I just know that you still have to eat and you still have to be able to, you know, support this habit called a telephone and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I wasn't saying you're assuming those. I'm saying the questions as I travel are usually somewhere in that spectrum. And I actually love answering this question.
Oh, good.
Because, number one, I make adventure my priority in life. And so when you make something a priority, things will start to happen. All of a sudden, I make different financial decisions. I pursue job opportunities that are more meaningful, that allow me more time to travel via bicycle and other human-powered means. I live very simply. When I'm not in my bike travel life, I live in a Dodge Sprinter van and a 12x8 camper that I've outfitted. So I have no debt, not because I'm some millionaire, but because I don't allow debt into my life. And how do I have any sort of income? In 2014, I started my own company called Tomfoolery Outdoors, which you mentioned a little bit ago. And I produce outdoor adventure events, bike tours, yoga, beer runs, and that's my source of income. It's a little surprising to me, but as I've advanced in my outdoor adventure career, I am getting some sponsorships, partnerships with nonprofits to help with some of the funding of my outdoor lifestyle. But it all starts with a choice and making it a priority.
I think that's awesome. What kind of bike are you riding?
I'm on a Soma Saga steel frame touring bike. It's a sturdy bike. I rode it from San Diego to Key West and riding it right now as well. So there's a lot of stories in that seat.
I'll bet there are. I want to talk a little bit about your gear, not just the bike itself, but you obviously are self-contained. So I know people everywhere always invite cyclists into their lives, either to have a meal or to sleep somewhere. But do you carry a tent and sleeping bag and all that other stuff?
Yeah. Every adventure that I've ever been on, including this bike tour, I'm fully self-supported. So I don't need anybody else to survive and make it on my journey, but I do, and I embrace that side of it. One of the coolest things about bicycle travel are the people that I meet along the way that invite me into their homes for a meal and allow me to do laundry and those types of things. So that's really cool. But I'm fully self-supported. So I have my backcountry style cooking set up for, I have about 2 days worth of food on me at any given time. I have a tent, sleeping bag, ground pad, stuff for typical camping accessories. One pannier for clothes, one pannier for kind of my electronics and bike lights and that type of thing, and another one for rain gear, spare tire, spare tubes, bike tools, that type of stuff.
So you actually look like you travel year-round.
In the last few years, that's been happening. Yeah, it's really cool how it's worked out. And I love all types of human-powered adventures, so biking, definitely. Bicycling is one of my favorite for sure. I'd rather be traveling than not.
So I'd like to cover a couple of your signature events this year, the Beer Miler, the Canoe Grass, and the Urban Yoga Movement. Well, I have a very special interest in yoga. I'm a yoga instructor.
Oh, right on.
Well, I have my own little studio. So, I teach seniors mainly. If you can get your ass on a mat, you can come to my class. So,
I love it.
What's the Beer Miler?
Yeah. Oh, so that goes back to the income side of things. In my tomfoolery outdoors world, I have the signature events you mentioned, and the tomfoolery Dayton Beer Miler is a one-mile run. It's held in downtown Dayton, Ohio. We partner with the Dayton Beer Company. It's a local craft brewery, and we do four laps around the brewery, one-quarter mile each, and at each turn, you're offered a beer to hydrate so you can make it through the next lap.
Right. Or not.
Or not. So we have a ball. About 300 people participate. We have food trucks and live music afterwards. And then we give a percentage of the proceeds to a local group called Roads to Recovery. It's a group that supports families and people with autism.
Nice. It looks like, I was just looking at the pictures from 2016. It looks like everybody was having a really good time. Is it a good beer? Do you like that beer?
Oh, yeah. Dayton Beer Company is top notch.
Yeah.
One of our better breweries in Dayton.
Cool.
And they're great hosts. Yeah, and people dress up in costumes. And
of course they do.
it's quite a festive scene for sure.
Let's talk about Canoe Grass, which I see is August 2nd through 5th. So it's in like a weekend event, it looks like. What's going on with that?
Yeah, Canoe Grass was the first event that I ever produced as Tomfoolery Outdoors. It was my kind of step into the world of event production. And I think if anybody wanted to know about my personality, about my company, just look at Canoe Grass. It's all of my favorite things smashed into one weekend. So camping, paddling, bluegrass music, all waterfront. So we have the event. Our stages are on the lake. Everybody hangs out in the water and watches the music. And we have now we have 15 bands over the weekend. People are coming from all over the Midwest. It's about 400 people. I intend on keeping it that size so it feels like you're going to a family reunion where you actually like the people.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's funny.
And we just about spending time on the water and listening to good music. People bike and hike to the event. And it's one of my favorite weekends of the year. In fact, it is my favorite weekend of the year.
Then it looks like you're already moving into next year with this urban yoga movement. What's your idea there? It's January of 2019, and you're saying it is time to do Yoga Dayton. What is the
right.
So tell me how you've put that together, and you're saying you're offering a variety of yoga disciplines and meditation and adventure. How did that come together, and where?
Yes, so it was born in Dayton, Ohio. Currently, my signature events are in Dayton, Ohio, but I'm open to taking some of these concepts elsewhere. Urban yoga movement, I'm definitely open to that. But I was born in Dayton, and my partner in the event is a yoga instructor, and we saw a need in our community to bring yoga instructors, enthusiasts together all in one place. You know, the different studios can operate in silos sometimes. And so we saw a need to bring all the varieties of yoga disciplines, meditation together all in one place. So it's a conference style day where you can choose between 2 to 3 sessions at a time, from an active session to maybe a lecture on a different related topic, and it's a full day. Last year we had 16 different sessions all related to yoga, meditation, and overall wellness.
How cool is that? I have been down to Yellow Springs for a yoga teacher training that I do occasionally. The teacher I usually study with has he's on sabbatical right now, but we love riding in that area too, because you have all of the Little Miami Trail sort of spurs coming out of Dayton and Springfield and Xenia.
Yeah, Yellow Springs is one of my favorite towns in Ohio, and if not in the country, really. And Dayton and Southwest Ohio are blessed with over 330 miles of paved bike trails. So plenty of places to explore on bicycle, and you would never even have to be on a road for those that are intimidated by riding with cars.
Let's tell our listeners again the name of your website, and then you'll get my three favorite questions.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
My website is tomfooleryoutdoors.com, and I'm also on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at Tom Foolery Outdoors.
Oh, cool. I have to go look up your YouTube thing. My husband keeps telling me, you know, the Outspoken Cyclist needs to do some events so you can have your own YouTube channel, because I sit in the studio, you know, and record all this stuff, and there's nobody here but me. Anyway, let me ask you my favorite questions. What is your favorite food?
My favorite food, whatever's in my mouth.
Good answer.
I mean, as an adventuring cyclist, it's just, I'm hungry all the time. It's crazy.
Right. So whatever somebody's willing to feed you.
Yeah, but if I have choice in the matter, I love all types of seafood, scallops, crabs, clams, lobster, fish. I love seafood.
Well, you're heading up the East Coast. You should be running into seafood territory any second now.
Yeah, I've been taking advantage of it as I've been riding up the coast, for sure. And then, you know, just something good and hearty. I have a hard time passing up a burrito.
Yeah, a nice filling burrito, right? It fills you up.
Yeah.
So
yes.
I know that you probably do not, or you might listen to music on your bike, but you like bluegrass. We know that. What other music do you like?
Bluegrass definitely at the top of the list. Reggae music, a little bit of, I'd say, you know, it could fall into some jam band type stuff, but definitely bluegrass and reggae at the top. Anything that is fun to listen to around a campfire.
And both of those are, all of that is. So I know this is probably going to be a no because you're on the road so much, but do you have any pets?
I do not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do not have a pet, any pets. I'm not married. I don't have kids. So that does help. When you asked earlier about my adventure lifestyle, seems like I'm on the move a lot. That does help. I do have folks that automatically assume that I don't have any of that, you know, a pet or a wife or kids or any of that stuff. But I know plenty of folks that still adventure with pets and family and all that, too. So I hope listeners won't let that distract them from pursuing whatever adventure means to them.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because I think that people can always find time for an adventure if they plan their lives around that idea. I really appreciate you talking with me today. TomFooleryOutdoors.com. There are other services and options on the site, and including guide services and speaking and team building and support. And I really enjoyed talking with you. Kim was right. You're a lot of fun. And hopefully I can meet up with you sometime, maybe right here in Ohio when you get back home.
I think that's a must. Yeah, I look forward to meeting you down the road. We'll connect back in the Buckeye State at the end of my journey.
Okay. Well, you have a safe journey, and we'll talk again. Thanks so much, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Diane. Take care.
Bye-bye. Oh, yeah, that was a fun conversation. Tom Helbig, TomFooleryOutdoors.com, living the life. He's somewhere near Delaware. If you're interested, go on out to his website and take a look around. Maybe you want to catch up with the Beer Miler or the urban yoga movement. Just some really cool stuff going on. He's certainly an interesting guy. So we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back to talk with Brian Chapman of Chapman Cycles in Rhode Island. Looks like an East Coast show today. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. My next guest is a frame builder in the most classic sense. Here's my conversation with Brian Chapman of Chapman Cycles. Hello, Brian. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Congratulations on your win at NABS. Quite an honor. We'll talk about that bike in a bit because it's a tandem and I ride a tandem. So I love tandems. I take it you ride a tandem?
I do. So this tandem, I know you said you were going to talk about it later.
Oh, we can talk about it now. That's fine.
So my wife and I had a Jack Taylor tandem, UK frame builder from a while back. And we loved it, but there were so many things I wanted to change about it. So I made one for us, and then I made a trailer, and then I made some racks, and it just kind of spiraled out of control.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
I want this rake. No, let's try that rake. No, let me build a front rack. I understand how that goes. I've seen it with my own eyes.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it all started, it was just a bunch of plans, but they finally came together. And then I don't know where I found the time, but I ended up building it. So there you have it.
Well, it's quite lovely, I must say. Can we talk a little bit about your background, where you grew up and how you got into cycling and then into frame building?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Go for it.
Well, I'm a New England person. So people, for anyone who doesn't know, I'm located in Rhode Island, the biggest little state in the union, as they call it. And I didn't grow up in Rhode Island, but I grew up nearby in Attleboro and New Bedford. So those were my formative years. Do you want to hear about how I got into the bike world or bikes?
Do you have the bicycle gene? Were you born with it? Like, that was it? Once you figured out about bikes, that was where you went?
You know, I don't think anyone's born with it.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Oh, you do? Well, anyway, I don't know if I was born with it, but I definitely had an affinity for bikes from an early age. And it was mostly, for me, it was because my neighborhood, this was 1983 or so, when the BMX craze was really starting to take off. We had a local BMX track, and I had some friends who raced. And everyone in my neighborhood, like all the kids my age, 11 or 12, 13, all had BMX bikes. And you kind of not had to have a BMX bike, but I sure pestered my mom to get my Super Goose off of the one advertiser, which was like the Craigslist back in the day. So I could be part of that crew because it was weird. Like, I don't really, I mean, I know we're not like defined by the things we own, but, as a child, you kind of feel like you're in this mindset where you need to have a thing, whether it's nowadays it might be an Xbox or something. That's how out of touch I am. Maybe Nintendo's back in the game, but you need this thing so you can hang. And, for me, it was the bike, and I liked riding a lot, and I didn't want to just, like, hang. I wanted to ride, and then, I don't know, everyone has the same story, it seems, but I rode a lot. I raced, and then I did freestyle BMX, and I still ride BMX from time to time because it's so damn fun. And do you want me to keep going?
Of course.
Okay.
This is your conversation.
I don't know, just, like, well, you know, I hear my own story and I'm kind of like, oh my God, does anyone want to hear this? But,
I'm going to tell you that people do want to hear this and they'll enjoy it just like I'm enjoying it. I'm just sitting here smiling. Yeah, you can't see me, but
okay.
I have a great face for radio, but go ahead.
So I ended up riding a lot and then to the point where we would ride to the local bike shop. There was a bike shop that opened in Attleboro and it was almost BMX specific because the industry was so booming at the time. And that the person who owned that shop, they're still in business now, which is fantastic, 30 plus years later. And they were very supportive of the scene, I guess you could call it, and made sure that, you know, kids were on bikes all the time. And I ended up working there when I turned 16. So that would be 1987. And I got the job there because I built a set of wheels, and I didn't have a touring stand, so I used my Univega, and I built the wheels. I went up to a bike mash bar and bought a bunch of parts, which I'm sure as a bike shop, I mean, even in 1987, it was happening where, you know, you're just looking for the deal. Nowadays, people go online. But anyway, I went to bike mash bar and bought my Campagnolo rims and hubs and my DT spokes, and I built up a set of wheels using Brandt's book. And I brought them to him because I didn't have a touring stand. And then he saw the wheels, and he's like, these are awesome. They're fantastic. And so I ended up getting a job there and working there for on and off for 10 years. He was basically my foot in the door, which I think is what, in order to get in this industry, someone, you got to have that person. He was that person for me. And I feel like I kind of forced my way in there by just hanging out at the shop all the time. And even, I don't know, I don't know why he hired me. I'm psyched that he did. And then from there, that was my introduction to the bike industry. And I have a lot to thank for Rick at Union Cycle in Attleboro. I'll plug them.
I'm glad you are plugging them. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brian Chapman from Chapman Cycles in Rhode Island. And so that's the way we find great people for our shops, are people like you who hang out and soak up all of the information and all of the technique and all of the product and read all the magazines and, you know, touch all the spokes and touch all the headsets and all. And that's how great cycling people are, like, formed, you know? It's like, that's the vacuum form for
great.
I agree.
Yeah. I agree. But having worked at a shop, there are some people who hang out at the shop that are not like that, but it's still fun to have them around.
Yeah, but every once in a while,
time pass.
Every once in a while, we get one like you, and, you know, that's what we wait for. It's like, yeah, you're right. You might get 20 and only one is good. So when did you actually start building frames? Okay, I heard that you built your first pair of wheels, which is awesome because I believe in hand-built wheels. When did you start building frames?
Well, so that happened much later. So, like, I went to school in 1992. I ended up going to UMass for mechanical engineering, thinking that I was going to build bikes. I really didn't know what I was going to do. I was just a directionless teenage kid. And I ended up graduating and going to work at Brown instead, doing IT work, because I had worked my way through college doing IT, like computer work there. And coincidentally, I was living in Providence at the time, and Chris Bull moved his shop, Circle A Cycles, from Worcester, Mass, down to Providence, literally like a third of a mile down the street from where I live. I didn't know him. There are a lot of mills in the town, so anyone could move there. I mean, he could have moved anywhere, but if this was like, I don't know, whatever, fate.
Serendipity.
You believe in that? Serendipity.
Is that a good word?
So that's the word. That
okay.
Is the word. So, it was a great coincidence. The planets aligned. And so I found out about him, and then I ordered a bike from him. I didn't go there wanting to work right away. I wanted to know what he did, because he was starting this anarchist bike collective, frame building collective. And I was like, it sounds like something I want to be part of, because I have it just kind of jived with a lot of my interests and beliefs. And so I got a bike from him first, and then I started apprenticing there. And I was there for 2 years, and then I built my first bike in 2005, and then the rest is downhill. Uphill history.
Overhill.
Actually, it was all uphill. So, the rest is history.
So, basically, you build classic, what I call classic bikes, steel, lugged, or Philip Ray's. You use steel forks, I think. You probably make your own forks. So, I assume that's how you were sort of taught by Chris, but even people who have been taught by masters have sort of gradually sort of gone in other directions. Some of them went to carbon, some of them went to aluminum, but you've stuck with this brazed, lugged method. So do you... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I don't... At Circle A, we would build lots of road frames with traditional road geometry with carbon forks because you could make a sub, 17 or 16-pound road frame out of steel, and it would be cool. It'd be fun to have the super light bike, but you're so restricted when designing the bike. If you're like, you can only have this fork height and this fork offset, and you're just and it just created this aesthetic too, where I eschew. It's like whenever I see a carbon fork, I'm like, you had the opportunity to make this a real, really unique custom frame. I'm sounding a little judgmental here, but I just want to say that there's nothing wrong with carbon because it does have a place in the bike world. But I feel like a custom builder has this perfect opportunity to really hone their the geometry that they're designing for. And instead, they're just going by what the industry has defined to be the right geometry for a road bike. It's frustrating for me to see, but I will not build with carbon forks. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you do not have to apologize to me. I promise.
No, I'm apologizing to the people who want carbon forks.
Well, and I do understand it. And I see it every day because my Brian does exactly the same thing you do. And it's all about the geometry and the fit. And if you can't make that bike work that way, then it will not ride the way you, as the designer, had hoped it would ride. So I totally get it. I do totally get it. Do you blend your tubing?
So on that note, yes, I do blend my tubing. On that note, there are so many different fork blades to choose from. I mean, you can really... dial in the feel of the bike based on the person's the riding style, whether they're going to be racks or fence, just all sorts of stuff, the height of the fork. And you can, as a builder, it just gives you so much more freedom. And so, yes, I do blend tubing using a lot of Columbus and Betachai. That's mostly because I built with that at Circle A for so long, but I use a lot of Reynolds, rest in peace. And then some Tongay and KSI, different brands, because there's so many different tubes out there. You can really curate like the perfect frame set for the rider based on their weight, their riding style, the size bike it's going to be, etc.
Yeah, I got it. That's so cool. Do you do mainly...
Also, I just don't think it's like just to use one brand of steel just to get a sticker on the frame is kind of silly to me nowadays.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's interesting. I don't even think about tubing stickers anymore. I mean, it used to be that it had to be a Reynolds 531 or a Columbus SLX. That's so interesting.
Right.
I haven't even thought about that in years and years and years. Wow. So before we move on, I'm going to... suggest that we take a quick break and we'll come right back and we're going to talk about some of the things that you do accomplish with your design and fit and how the clients find you. Can you hang with me for a couple seconds?
I can.
Okay. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back to talk with Brian Chapman. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back, and if you're just joining me, I am speaking with frame builder Brian Chapman. He is in Rhode Island, and he builds classic bikes, and it makes me very happy to be able to talk to him about this particular subject since it's near and dear to my heart. When you say that you use classic styling, or would you say that you use classic styling for things like seat clusters and fork crowns, and what would that mean to you if you do?
Well, so my frames that I build are all steel. So, I mean, I guess by this day and age, like if you were to walk into a bike shop, you won't see a bike that looks like the ones that are custom made, like lug fillet brace frames, because, well, it's probably not cost effective. But even if you do see a steel frame, most likely it's TIG welded. So I don't do TIG welding. So I guess they all look kind of classic. Like when I run into someone on the street and they say, nice bike. And they just immediately think it's vintage. And I think right. It's hilarious, but it is what it is.
It might be vintage thinking.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Right. They're the vintage inspired.
Right.
I like to think that I mean some of the design aspects you mentioned, the seat cluster, or whether it's like how I treat the dropouts or carve a lug, they are totally inspired by other builders from the past. So that will inherently influence my style.
To accomplish a fit, and I know there are a lot of people who want classic frames usually want parallel top tubes. Do you actually sort of work with your lugs so that you can accomplish? I know there are some lugs that'll give you like a 6-degree slope. Do you do some sloping top tubes for people if that's what they want?
Yes, definitely. There are needs people need certain very specific fits sometimes, and lugs can be restricting. I've done different styles of building, including bilaminate and just regular fillet brazing that give you complete geometric freedom when making the bike. I don't do a lot of sloping top tubes, but finessing the geometry to get the bars and saddle in the right place is a fun art, I would like to say, because like there are so many tiny things you can do, and it will give you a centimeter here and a centimeter there,
right,
or a millimeter here even, and then you end up just dialing in that fit. And I think I have so much fun with BikeCAD, the program that most frame builders use these days for designing bikes. And you can just sit there and just play around and like drop the bottom bracket just a hair, and then like make the C-tube a little longer. And then if you're shooting for a certain aesthetic and you're not concerned about standover height and other things, it just can really, it's really freeing. And it's fun to try and, you know, to design a bike for a threadless stem, but not have 42 million
spacers
in it or something.
Yeah, right. Why not? So I want to ask you a question that I don't understand. And I saw it on your site. There's a blue frame with a bilaminate. It has this really cool head section. What do you mean by bilaminate? That's a term I am not particularly familiar with.
So builders back in the 50s, even Claude Butler and like Alex Singer used to do bilaminate constructions where it's a combination of lug and fillet brazing. So you have this, you'll see a lug edge, but there is no lug defining the geometry. Although those older builders, they still built with level top tubes, and lugs would have been perfectly adequate, but they were distinguishing themselves as builders.
I get it.
And nowadays, it's totally not necessary. It's just a way for builder to do something different, to make something unique. And that blue bike, it was actually a lot of work because I basically built the bike and then carved away the head tube and silver brazed another head tube inside of it. And it was just a funny technique that I don't normally do.
Well, it looks cool.
Thanks.
And I assume that because this is this guy's fourth bike, he's not unhappy with it.
No. He's an anomaly. He's an amazing guy, and he understands like what I build, and so he's like every time he gets a bike, he's always thinking about the next one, and I'm very flattered by that. But I mean, I would never ever be offended if he went to another builder to have another custom bike made.
Yeah, sure.
But he really knows what I build and knows my my expertise, I guess you can say, and pushes me in directions like that bilaminate frame, which I wouldn't normally go. And I appreciate it. Actually, he's really fun to work with.
And those kind of customers are always welcome, you know, as long as you can,
yes.
You know, when you can work with somebody who likes your work and is willing to let you sort of express your artistic, you know, bent. That's nice, too. I think that's really
it
good.
Is.
Yeah. They say, well, you
only have to take his measurements once.
Right. And there is that. There is that. You know,
sorry,
his
what did
fit.
You, say? I apologize.
You know his fit. So do clients usually come to you?
Yeah. That's a funny thing about frame building. Like when I started doing my own thing in 2011, I built for my wife and then I built for friends. No one knew who I was aside from like the builder who used to be at Circle A. And so you kind of have to hustle to get a business. You have to really build bikes to sell bikes. So that's my business tip. And I am not a business person. So anyway, I
that's a good one though.
You just have to build stuff. You have to keep making, and then people will see, and then magically you might end up with like a 3-month wait list. And now it's up to 22 months right now.
Wow.
24 because two people just got on the list today. And it's exciting, but it's also, there's a lot of stress. I don't like the list. I wish I could just like magically make the bike, but they take so damn long to make. For me, it takes me a full month because I only do complete bikes. I don't do frame sets or racks and stuff. I just do bikes. And it always takes about a month, like with all the racks and the fenders, the lighting, everything integrated. It just ends up being intense, the paint and the masking and fun stuff.
It's so funny hearing you talk about this stuff because I just so know exactly, you know, I can see myself walking into our workshop and seeing Brian working on what looks like the same frame for a while. And I realize that's what it takes, you know, that kind of detail and that kind of, you know, those little nuances about that plug for that lamp or that, you know, little whatever it is, slotting that brake ferrule that the wire has to go through.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuances when building a bike, and there are a lot of shortcuts you could take. Like in the 70s, during the bike boom, when people were making bikes with no brazons, that bike, you could make it in a day if you didn't do any finish work on it and just like soaked it and then painted it.
Right.
The standards have been raised so high by the work that these custom builders are making. Like if you go to any handmade bike show and it's everyone's competing for those customers and they're making these beautiful bikes. And I have to be on my toes all the time. I have to be like, just keep making the best I can make because like there's so many talented builders out there right now. Now when people come to me and they're not local, I always tell them to like, well, where are you from? Who are your local builders? And I can recommend someone most of the time.
Right. Right.
If they don't want to wait too. That's the other thing.
You mentioned paint. Do you paint your own bikes?
I paint my own bikes. I learned at Circle A by doing the entire process from fit to assembly. So it's and billing. And I kind of use that. I use all my knowledge from there. We did a lot of repair work too. Doing the repairs, you have to do paint work, restoration work. I don't do painting of other people's bikes, but I do. I just did a paint job on a Circle A. So I will do stuff like that, or maybe stuff for close friends every once in a while. But it's I try to avoid the paint because of its incredible toxicity.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. You want to keep doing this.
I have a son, so I do take like all the precautions with supplied air and suits and masks and gloves, et cetera, but it's still, it's not the best thing to be exposed to.
Yeah. Right. So I take it you also, build your own wheels.
I do.
Yeah. Wheel building is such a cool art.
It's very satisfying.
I know. I don't build wheels. I lace wheels, but you would never want me to you would never want me to tension your wheels. They would be square. They would not be round.
I'm sure you would do just fine.
I don't know about that.
I remember when I was first starting out, I was winging it when I first started out, and they ended up being mostly round. It took a long time, and then, you know, you get better at it.
Yeah, you do.
Anything.
All right, so here's the question. Disc, caliper, canty. Where are you with all those?
What about center pull brakes?
Well, I guess I look at caliper as being a style of center pull.
I guess you're right. Yeah, with all the direct mount stuff these days, it kind of looks like a center pull.
You're talking about like the Pauls and that kind of thing?
Yeah, like the old Mayfac race.
No, that's a caliper of a sort, right?
I guess it's a direct mount caliper, yes.
Okay.
So I would say that as long, I love all brakes as long as they stop.
There's a good idea.
So there are brakes out there that don't stop very well, and you can really adjust and tune them to increase mechanical advantage and such. But there are some brakes out there that are just kind of garbage and hopeless, and you just got to let it go. But I really do like disc brakes. I'm really trying to embrace them. But with a steel frame, you really, I really have to overbuild certain aspects of the bike. I don't like flat mounts, and I don't know. There are all sorts of things like that I find. Diane, I can be judgmental sometimes, and I don't want to be, but I'm not a huge fan of discs, but there is a time and a place. Off-road, I think they make a ton of sense, but like on a road bike, I don't know, not so much.
I can't disagree. This has been, I don't know how many podcasts you've listened to, but if you've listened to me talk to builders for the last 5 years, everybody gets asked the same thing. What do you think about discs on road bikes? And I still can't embrace it. I know that now the first and only time we've ever needed a disc, we realized, was we went to Israel last fall. We came down this unbelievable mountain and on the tandem, and we needed to stop the bike because we overheated the rim. So that's the first and only time, though, in 18 years of riding together that we've had that problem. And so I guess eventually we're going to probably have a disc on the rear of the tandem. But for other than that, I just don't see it. I don't know.
Does the tandem not have a drag brake? Like
It did. I think it might have it depends on which wheel. We have, like, of course, more than one set of wheels for that bike. I don't remember what we took. So I really don't know. So
only reason I ask is because on that tandem that I made, I put a Philwood disc on the back, which has, and it's notorious for failing.
Right.
And but I'm only using it as a drag brake. But oh my gosh, is it ever a conversation starter? That's the first thing. Like I really regret bringing that to the show in some aspects, because people are very passionate about their brakes apparently, and they were just ripping through, because I had made the cantilevers on there, and then I had to fill wood on there that was doesn't have the best reputation. And so it's just funny all the brakes on the tandem stop fantastic, but as far as the mountain pass, I don't think I'll put a disc on or an Arai at that point.
Yeah, I don't even know if we still have an Arai brake in the shop. We probably do somewhere. You know, it's somewhere. Everything's got to be somewhere.
They stopped making them, didn't they?
They did indeed. So you already said that it takes you a month to do a bike, and that you've got this long waiting list now. Do you think a lot of that waiting list came from NABS?
No, not so much.
Oh, cool.
Getting
that yourself.
When NABS started, I was working at Circle A, and I was like, oh, this is cool, but it's in California, or it's in Texas, or wherever, everywhere else but here. And I was like, oh, whenever it comes here, I got to go. And this year, I was like, oh, it's going to be in Connecticut. I was like, I got to go.
So that's correct.
And it was, because if I didn't go, it just sends weird signals too. I'm getting out of the business. If you're a builder and the show is near you, I feel like you're obligated to go unless you have some sort of really personal issues about the going to the show, or financial too, because it is an expensive thing to do.
Yes, it is.
So I have to be picky and choosy about the shows I go to. I love going to shows because I get to talk to people, and then, because I don't know if I mentioned this, but my shop is just like a 16 by 20 like shed in my backyard, and I'm there alone for hours on end, so I don't really get to talk to people.
You're a hermit.
To be able to get out and talk about the bikes is very exciting for me.
Were you at the Builders Ball and I missed you?
Yeah, we missed
you. How
each other.
Is that possible?
It was busy at the booth.
Yeah, that's good though. That was good. If you were
no,
busy.
I was there at the Builders Ball. I will be there again this year.
Good.
Eric, on a fantastic event, September 22nd. Mark your calendars.
Indeed. So I'm gonna. We're gonna need to wrap it up. Unfortunately, this has been a wonderful conversation so far. But what do you do when you aren't building bikes?
That's funny you ask. I spend a lot of time with my family as much as possible. I have a 2-year-old. And he is incredibly fun to be around, and I just love watching him grow and develop. Aside from family stuff, I listen to a lot of music. I DJed for 13 years at a college station, so I kind of just I feed off of listening to all sorts of new stuff in the shop. And I ride bikes. I ride bikes a lot, BMX, off-road, on-road, just anywhere, usually with a destination of coffee or ice cream, but just for fun.
So if I walked out the door of this studio and took a left and walked in the other door, it's the Air Studio where the college DJs are running this station. Speaking of college.
Oh, I love it.
I know.
It.
I've been doing this almost 8 years. So I have 3 questions I have to ask you. And I already know about your music, but we don't know which tastes you have. But what's your favorite food?
Oh, I eat a lot of lentils and rice. So I'm a vegetarian, so I have a, I don't know. Let's just leave it at lentils and rice.
Okay.
I eat so much of it.
So you must like it, right?
I love it. I love Indian food, too. So I'm just,
there you go. So you tell me you listen to all kinds of music. What do you have, a particularly favorite kind of music that you like, or a genre?
So if I had to, like, put on something in the shop that was going to give me motivation and and relaxation, I always go to King Tubby and Aggravators. So just any sort of dub album from late 70s, early 80s, King Tubby era. It's my favorite. So I dig that. But I also listen to a lot of kind of noise, like Stars of the Lid or Low Soul or these other Cranky Records bands. So I kind of like music that will, it's either active listening or it falls into the background. So it rides that fine line.
How about pets? Do you have any pets?
Oh, we just lost our border collie last week.
Oh, no! Brian loves border collies. Aww.
So, yeah, it's still an open wound.
She
was a fantastic dog. No, it's okay. Dogs, they become part of the family, and she was my shop companion, and so now it's extra quiet in the shop these days.
Well, there'll be another one who comes along for you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to have this conversation with me. I really enjoyed it. And I probably will not be at Builders Ball this year just because I have some other obligations. And we're going to go to Philly this year, which we didn't do last year.
Ah.
Oh, yeah. Bina, you know, I got to do the Bina thing every once in a while. So thank you so much. I have a wonderful day. And we'll talk again.
I like that.
Okay. Bye-bye. Brian Chapman joined me from his little bike shack, as he puts it, in Rhode Island. I like the way he thinks. If you're interested, you can log on to his website, chapmancycles.com. Thanks again to Tom Helbig from tomfooleryoutdoors.com, and thank you for listening to the show this week. Please remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Outspoken Cyclist without an E. And if you have a comment or a suggestion, post it. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. And in the meantime, stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.